dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We are escorting you about, as ever, a bit of the battle space of the war for the free world, as we like to think of it. And we are joined as our lead-off batter, as is the case each week, I'm happy to say, for our Week in Review session with Fred Grandy, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Executive Vice President, a former member of Congress, a man who ran Goodwill Industries, was a talk radio show host in his own right, and is now joining us to make sense of what is happening in the war for the free world. Fred Grandy, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you. I actually think that, to use your baseball analogy, we scored a run.
We did. I think a home run.
Yeah.
Maybe cleaned the bases. Who knows? What happened in Kansas?
Well,
American laws for American courts.
We've been trying to get the legislature, as we have in many states, to pass American laws for American courts. And they did. 120-0 in the House, 33-3 in the Senate. And it now is on Governor Brownback's desk, and we have a pretty good assurance that he will sign it. Now, this was not before there was a little bit of mischief afoot, as there always is.
The mischief. Making the mischief?
Well, the usual suspects, CARE, the ACLU, co-opting members into thinking that somehow this is Islamophobic, the usual narratives. CARE is out in force, encouraging the governor not to sign it. But I have to feel as though this time, I think what we were able to do, Frank, was allay people's concerns before they actually got to final passage. And unlike Florida and Georgia, where we were essentially trumped at the last minute, I think we actually trumped them. Now, I hope that is a preview of coming attractions, because, as you know, ALAC is still on the docket in Missouri and Alabama before these state legislative sessions end. But I'm also hoping that we are beginning to build capacity among state legislators who see the value of this. Now, just as you know, it just so happened a case fell into our lap this week of a professor of physics at Wichita State who had been trying to divorce his wife under Sharia and leave her with essentially nothing. And the court,
His third wife.
Yeah, he makes a practice of this. Yeah. And that just happened to coincide with final passage.
But one might call that providential.
Well, it is, but it's also the compendium of cases which we've now, what's the running total? 51, 52 that we've actually documented.
Yeah.
And for those legislators that say it can't happen here, I just have to say, well, then how do you argue against what's happening in your own courts right now in Sedgwick County?
Right. Let's recap, because we sort of jumped into the byplay with our base-clearing exercise metaphor. This is legislation that has been considered in a number of places, Kansas being the fourth to adopt it,
right,
following Tennessee, Louisiana, and Arizona.
Right.
It simply says you may not use foreign laws, not just Sharia, but any foreign law that violates constitutional rights and state public policies in the courts of that state. Seemingly unobjectionable. And yet, as you say, Fred Grandy, we're witnessing the Muslim Brotherhood front organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, ICNA, the Islamic Circle of North America.
They've got a $3 million campaign to tell us that.
$3 million Sharia boosting exercise. That actually this kind of law shouldn't be applied. Heartening indeed, and hats off to Representative Peggy Mast in Kansas, who really helped move the ball there. And as you say, I hope this is a model for what's to come next. But speaking of Sharia, let's turn our sights for a moment to Egypt, a country we've been sadly witnessing coming under increasing domination by this organization that is trying to bring Sharia worldwide. Interesting developments, perhaps, at least among the electorate in Cairo there, that bears on the presidential race now underway. What's the latest on
that? Well, the latest is that evidently the Muslim Brotherhood stock is plunging to some degree. Their presidential candidate, who is their second or third choice, an engineer, by the way, with a degree from the University of Southern California.
Naturally.
You notice how many of these leaders get their degrees in the United States and then go back to wage war on us?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this guy's name is Mohammed Morsi, and he was the Muslim Brotherhood's presidential candidate and was supposedly the front runner until recently, and now all of a sudden he is considered the underdog behind a gentleman named Amer Moussa, who is a former Arab League official, and you'll love this, a gentleman named Abdel Fattah, who is described as a moderate Islamist.
Yes, a moderate Islamist.
Now, how you keep those two words together in the same sentence without combustion, I don't know. But this is interesting because, as you know, our senior fellow, Cynthia Farahat, has been following this election from the inside and said earlier this week, because there was a Pew poll that came out and said, Muslim Brotherhood, very popular, people want democracy and Islamism. And she looked at this poll and said, this has nothing to do with reality on the streets of Cairo. The Muslim Brotherhood is fading in popularity because, for one thing, they haven't done what they promised they were going to do. They haven't separated from the military. The economy is terrible. And a lot of these lunch pail issues that we talk about domestically in this country are obviously affecting voters in Cairo. They're still strong in the parliament because they control the rural precincts. But their stock in, obviously, the center of culture and commerce in Egypt is now going down. Will they lose? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the question really is, in a way, Fred Grandy, if the so-called moderate Islamist wins, won't that be tantamount to their winning as well?
Yeah.
And you know, you asked the question, how do you keep moderate and Islamist together? I think the answer is with smoke and mirrors.
Well, case in point, the Prime Minister of Turkey, Recep Erdogan, who is if nothing, one of the great bait-and-switch artists now in power in the Middle Eastern world, because he supposedly is this reformist Islamist who is actively leading a charge against Israel, and a big proponent of the OIC, which, as you know, is trying to advance blasphemy laws worldwide.
To the extent that we're witnessing the wheels coming off of this train, even before these guys succeed in imposing Sharia, it's a hopeful sign.
It is.
But as you say, unfortunately, even if they manage to be defeated in this presidential race, the people running the parliament, the people writing the new constitution, and the people who are, let's face it, at that point, because they're the most organized and disciplined and ruthless of the community, are quite likely to prevail, I'm afraid. So this is a subject that we'll be watching closely with your good help, Fred Grandy. Let me turn to one other thing very quickly before we run out of time. There is a lot of consternation, including among some people who are reasonably sensible, about whether the Obama administration is obtaining powers, in this case, from the Congress, rather than simply announcing that they obtained them through executive fiat, in connection with the National Defense Authorization Act that would effectively permit the government to begin rounding up Americans, arresting them, subjecting them to military and indefinite incarceration. We have members of Congress trying to change the law in such a way that would basically give all kinds of rights to terrorists. What's going on here?
Well, the lyrics are definitely out of the Ron Paul songbook. This is the same kind of broadside that's been launched against the Patriot Act time and time again. But essentially what they're saying is this administration, or any administration, wants to use the military to incarcerate civilians, anybody. And what this amendment that we are seeing being offered to the National Defense Authorization Act does is give the right of a civilian trial to anyone in this country, whether it's you or me or Mohammed Atta, had they apprehended him
prior. One of the hijackers of
the 9/11 attack. Now, there's a guy named Justin Amash, who is a young Republican who's co-sponsoring this with the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith of Washington. And I cannot understand why he's even there, except to the degree that I think he has, to some degree, been beguiled by this Paulist movement that thinks that any kind of government attempts to prevent sedition and empower security are essentially abridging your individual rights.
Right.
And there's no case, there's no legal case to be made for this.
Yes, exactly right. And unfortunately, there's a very strong legal case that, as you say, we will wind up greatly strengthening and emboldening the terrorists. Fred Grandy, we have to let it go at that. We'll be following this story, the drama of what will happen with the Amash Smith Amendment, and much, much more with you next week. Thanks for joining us, as always. Thanks for the great work at the Center.
Thank you. Keep
it up, and we'll talk with you in the week ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
We could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Captain Justin Springer, United States Army retired. He is not only a man who has served his country in uniform, in combat, in some of the worst in Iraq, but has gone on in his post-military career to make a film that is a very important treatment of a subject that he obviously had occasion to confront firsthand during his time in uniform, and in the course of making an extraordinary film entitled A Long Recovery. A bit of a double entendre there. Justin Springer, thank you so much for joining us. Your film will be airing this weekend in the GI Film Festival here in Washington, D.C., Saturday afternoon at 4 at the Naval Heritage Center. Congratulations on the film, and give us a little bit of your background and how it is that you came to think this was an important topic to cover.
Well, thank you very much for having me, first off. I served active duty with the 1st Brigade of 1st Infantry Division for a little over 5 years. I was a communications officer with two different battalions on two separate deployments in Iraq. My second deployment in particular in 2007, I was serving with the 1st Engineer Battalion, and our mission was route clearance operations, which involved patrolling the heavily trafficked areas for U.S. forces and looking for and clearing IEDs And as a result,
those being, of course, improvised explosive devices that have been used with devastating effect against our troops, and particularly, as you say, movement of their equipment and personnel on the roads of Iraq and now in Afghanistan.
Oh, that's correct. Right. In 2007, at that point, you know, improvised explosive devices had really become the signature weapon of the war. They're highly effective. They're very cheap to manufacture. So, as a result of our operations and many units were, you know, exposed to blasts on a daily basis. So we began to see changes in our soldiers in our battalion. Most of the guys, there was no physical wounds. There's nothing that you could see that they might be having problems. But cognitively, we started noticing guys weren't as performing as well. Behavioral problems, problems with sleep. And so it kind of really came to a head halfway through our deployment. Our battalion commander started pushing to evacuate some of these guys. The military had not developed a protocol yet to begin evacuating soldiers for concussions.
Hadn't really even identified the syndrome that's now come to be called traumatic brain injury, right?
That's correct. And in 2007, to the military's credit, they actually, that's kind of when, you know, after, you know, 6-7 years of war, including Afghanistan, they really came to realize that this is a problem. Exposure to blasts was affecting soldiers, giving them concussions, also known as traumatic brain injuries. And they actually had a mandatory training class that we received while we were in Iraq about concussions, what to look for and the symptoms. And they also started doing some screenings, but, you know, soldiers being, you know, who they are, you know, there's a little bit of a tough guy syndrome in the military. So, you know, guys didn't want to be evacuated for an invisible injury. And that's really where, you know, I began to see all this coming to a head in Iraq, and, you know, was worried. I guess I was worried, what the long-term effects might be for the injury. You know, friends of mine, were not themselves. And so that was really the motivation to kind of, you know, I personally wanted to know what was happening. I knew what combat was like. So I didn't want to make a documentary about that. But what I did want, you know, what I was interested in is what happens when you're evacuated? What happens when you go home with this injury? And that's really where it started.
Let me reintroduce you. Justin Springer is our guest. He is the producer and director of a powerful new feature-length documentary entitled A Long Recovery, A-L-O-N-G, Recovery, about traumatic brain injuries, the kind that he saw afflicting his comrades in arms while in Iraq. And then tell us about what you did to cover their stories in the persons of four of these individuals who were subjected to this kind of, hidden but very deadly injury.
Well, I after receiving permission from the Army to film at their flagship hospital in San Antonio, the Brooke Army Medical Center, I wanted to choose a number of different soldiers who were kind of emblematic of the entire population. So, four different guys who would show the varied symptoms that soldiers have. This includes chronic pain, headaches, sleep deprivation, and then also just the post-traumatic stress that is involved. I mean, it's a very traumatic event being blown up and just being in combat, months of violence. And so that was what I was looking for, a variety of symptoms. And, I ended up settling on four guys. And the other idea was I wanted to get guys who had just gotten back from Iraq. So guys who were, or Afghanistan. So four guys who were just evacuated. And that's what I did.
Could really follow the arc of their treatment and then post-treatment recovery.
That's correct.
And since this is now, Justin, so widespread a problem for the military, to what extent is there really now effective treatment being provided to these guys? What did you find as you were chronicling their story in terms of their ability to overcome this really serious problem?
Well, unfortunately, for traumatic brain injuries and concussions, for the mild to moderate concussions, there's no FDA-approved treatment to help these guys get better. And that's even for civilians who have these injuries. So unfortunately, you know, when soldiers come back, the doctors have to kind of be upfront with them and say, we don't have anything that is proven to show that's going to help you get better. What we can do is we can teach you coping skills, and then we can give you medications that will help subdue some of the symptoms, because the biggest, the only, you know, type of treatment that works is really time and rest, you know, getting these guys to, you know, sit down and, you know, and sit in the quiet rooms and kind of just relax while their brain kind of, you know, and heals itself. You know, so that was one of the things that was kind of shocking to me, is like, what, there's no treatment? And that's really shocking for soldiers to hear. But the Army has really, you know, to their credit, they have thrown a lot of money and a lot of resources at this and trying to, you know, have guys become at least aware of the injury. Because I think that's one of the first biggest steps, is getting the guy to admit that he has a problem and coming forward and getting treatment.
Right. Justice Springer, in your trailer for the film, and unfortunately that's all I've had a chance to look at, there's a really interesting comment made by one of the soldiers you're following about kind of the extensive effort that's made to help soldiers separate from the Army, but basically no effort made to help them stay in it. Very quickly, if you would, tell us how the Army is viewing these folks. Are they irreparably damaged? Are they trying to keep some of them in uniform and connected with the force? Or, you know, what's their future, in short, I guess?
Well, it's really, it's very subjective based on soldier to soldier. For the most part, for the guy with the concussion, their job in a combat arms role is really over. Where you're going to have to be, aggressive and have be cognitively functioning on, you know, 100%, you know, like an infantry soldier. Unfortunately, with concussions, they're kind of trying to deter a lot of guys from going back into those roles. But the Army, the military is trying to get these guys to go into other positions, you know, more administrative roles and stuff, so they can continue their service, and do their 20 years if that's what they want. But it's really hard when you're 20 years old and, you know, this, you've wanted to be a soldier your whole life, and all of a sudden you're told that you can't be. So
you can't be in the combat arms sense of being a soldier, which of course is what it's fundamentally about for particularly these young men who are coming in to serve their country in the front lines. Justin Springer, we have to let it go at that. This is a most important film, and one of the reasons why I'm so high on this GI Film Festival, that it's showcasing films like yours. You've already won an award in another film festival, the Austin Film Festival. You've got 5-star rating across the board in bravery, courage, honor, and sacrifice for your film, A Long Recovery. I really am delighted that you've done it, and I hope it brings a whole new perspective for many of us on how important the contributions being made by these troops are and the sacrifice that's entailed. Keep up the good work, sir. We'll look forward to your future ventures and come back to us again soon if you would.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure.
Download podcasts, hear clips, read the bios of the amazing people Frank Gaffney interviews, all at securefreedomradio.org.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder, here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. At www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Smith. He is the president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute here in Washington, D.C., an organization that does incalculably important work on the free market and ensuring that we don't mess it up with regulation or other forms of mischief making, like, well, for example, an international agreement known as the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, better known as LOST, for Law of the Sea Treaty. Fred Smith, you and I have been comrades in arms on this treaty for longer than probably either of us care to remember, but one of the things that I think is really important for people who are probably first hearing about it now, as Senator John Kerry begins to prepare for hearings next week that will feature the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who will talk about how absolutely critical this treaty is to our security and to our commercial interests around the world and so on. I mean, you actually know something both about this treaty and about commerce. Give us your quick assessment of the genesis of this treaty, how it relates to today's world, if at all, and most especially what it would mean for our competitive position and commercial interests.
Well, the Law of the Sea Treaty is, in a sense, an artifact of an era back in the 50s, 60s, the post-World War II period, where the romantic illusion that all the world needed was for all of the politicians in the world, or representatives from all the nations of the world, to sit down in a room together, reason on, and make all the choices affecting mankind in a collectivist way, the United Nations. And then the mechanism would be a series of treaties, and the treaties would take areas that were still not clearly defined, like the Antarctic, like the moon. And then, of course,
the International Commons, as they call them.
The
right?
International Commons. And rather than do what history had suggested was the most sensible way of bringing those resources into a human relevant institutional framework, expanding property rights, and then before that, expanding national ownership rules through expanding ownership in the outer continental shelf, the EEC, and so forth. No, this was going to be leave it as a commons, but then let a commons, 200 politicians, decide how to make decisions about it. That was an archaic
politicians, idea. Or in some cases, just despots, kings, dictators, what have you.
Well, the 200 nations in the world include a large number of despot kings, and they're just stupid people. But the point is the realization that the best way to have resources managed was by someone, a small group in most cases, owning it, and then by trying to make best use of it, create the wealth that would benefit the rest of the world, dominated and increasingly dominated in the world, but not in these international commons. And as the role of private property even broke out in limited ways in China, India, wouldn't say in France yet, but in the rest of the world, the commons became the last place where this kind of a collectivist mentality was totally in control, and they desperately tried to get treaties to lock these up forever to ensure that these resources would never be useful for mankind.
Right. So, Fred Smith, let me just summarize what we've said so far. We have a treaty that is a throwback to a long bygone era when the Soviet Union and the non-aligned nations bestrode the earth, and they sought to redistribute wealth through this kind of international fiat in which 200 or whatever number of nations would...
Probably a few less than that.
At the time, thankfully, less, but now almost 200, would essentially try to micromanage all of these resources of 70% of the world's surface covered by the oceans. This doesn't sound like a good plan. Why is it at the moment that we are witnessing this concerted push to get it ratified, a treaty, let's remember, that was actually rejected for these sorts of reasons by President Reagan 30 years ago this year?
It is your grandmother's Oldsmobile or your grandfather's Oldsmobile. This has been around as an establishment relic for so long, it's like, well, let's dust it off and do it for the old team type. You know, you've got a group of people who are nice enough individuals, like soon-to-be former Senator Lugar and others, who really are internationalist in the most, I would say, collectivist sense of the word. They really believe that the nation state is a declining element rather than a critical competitive element for global achievement. And therefore, we really need to move as many things as possible to the international forum where the best and the brightest, immune from political pressures of the narrow-minded nationalist countries like the United States, can prevail. Now, nobody seriously believes that anymore, but that sort of dying ideological thing is trying to get one last piece of flesh, and Law of the Sea Treaties is they've lost on cap and trade, they've lost on a series of others. Law of the Sea Treaties.
Greenhouse gases. Global warming. But Fred, I guess the question is, this last
why
gasp.
Are they doing it?
This
yeah,
last
why
gasp.
Are they doing it?
Well, yeah. Before we come back to that, but this last gasp would be one thing if it was just sort of a commendation for, his service to the country, to Dick Lugar, and that would be that. But it actually would have very far-reaching implications, as you've documented in testimony before the Foreign Relations Committee the last time they went through this goat rope. Give us a sense of that.
Well, the national security implications better, but generally speaking, it would turn the use of the resource, of the ocean resources outside the littoral rims of nation states, into something that would be determined by United Nations agencies. Not only the economic use of that resource, but the and to some extent the transit use of that. And you would never develop the oceanic resources under a Law of the Sea Treaty. So in effect it would deny 2/3 of the earth to mankind's future.
Now, in fact, that's not simply speculation. This treaty
that
has
is
been
exactly
described.
What it does.
Well, it's been described not just because of the bureaucratics of this, Fred Smith, but as you know, it's been described by, I think, President Clinton as the greatest environmental treaty of all time. And nobody knows better than you at the Competitiveness Enterprise Institute antipathy that environmentalists have to progress. So when you hear commercial interests like the oil and gas industry and now the Chamber of Commerce representing them and others vociferously insisting that they have to have this treaty, even though it is going to hand them over to regulators who make the EPA look like, you know, they're pets at the chamber. I can't fathom what they're thinking. Can you?
I think it. Well, first place, in this case, the companies that are supporting this tend to be Fortune 500 companies. They're largely led no longer by entrepreneurial capitalists, but by managers who are hired to be good managers of the company. Their approval, they get paid well, but their approval has to do with how well the country club clack views them. And the country club clack obviously loves CEOs who rise above mere profits to recognize their duties to the values of the world. And in that world, environmental approval is very, very high, and the whole class of things that go with environmental approval. So a lot of it is, it's not a big deal. There's no immediate plans to drill in the middle of the ocean or mine in the middle of the ocean. It's a frontier industry. Big business rarely is the one to be the most innovative part of the economy in any event. So, okay, they're giving up something for their product, for their successors. But on the other hand, they're getting a pat on the back, and who knows, they might get invited to Davos and get
citizens of the world. There you go.
Citizens of the world, exactly. I mean, Jeff Immelt's just one of the many out there like that. And why the chamber is doing this, I suspect, is the chamber's big members, you know, want to be citizens of the world, and they're very important to the chamber. Why the smaller members of the chamber, or more importantly, why the policy people at chamber aren't suggesting that this is suicidal to cut off 2/3 of the world from capitalism, from an innovative system that works, and give it over to a bureaucratic system that has produced nothing but poverty everywhere? It's hard to believe. It is really. We've talked to, as I suspect all of us have, and I think you and I have been on meetings of these, where we sit down with larger oil companies and talk to them, and they go through, they listen to us, they nod their heads, and they say, well, the top office thinks we've got to do this.
Yeah, that's as good a reason as any. Fred Smith, we have to wrap it for the moment at that, but this is going to be with us for a while, I think, and we are certainly going to be giving it a lot of coverage here at Secure Freedom Radio. I thank you very much for joining us and for the great work
Let's
you're
keep doing this
at the Competitiveness Enterprise Institute for the purpose of ensuring that all of us go into this with our eyes wide open as to why this treaty is not in America's interest, national security or commercial or otherwise. Fred Smith, thanks. We'll join you again soon, I hope. And we'll be talking with Bill Gertz up next about what's going on elsewhere inside the ring.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces, in the war of ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined inside the ring by our escort there, Bill Gertz, the Washington Free Beacon senior editor and columnist of the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times. Bill is also the author of, count them, six books, most wild bestsellers, including one of my personal favorites, The Failure Factory, How Unelected Bureaucrats, Liberal Democrats, and Big Government Republicans Are Undermining America's Security and Leading Us to War. Bill Gertz, a lot to cover with you today. You had a profile in the Beacon of a man I have been privileged to know and work with for a long time and admire greatly, Ambassador Robert Joseph, former Undersecretary of State for a variety of activities, including arms control. He really laid about him in the course of the conversations that you reported on. Tell us what Bob Joseph was warning of with respect to the Obama administration's national security record and policies.
Very significant speech by Bob Joseph. He gave it at a breakfast meeting earlier this week where he said that the Obama administration's weapons proliferation, non-proliferation policy was actually making the world more dangerous. And the examples he cited, obviously, were Iran and North Korea. In the case of Iran, he said basically the administration was obsessed with engagement and as a result had allowed the Iranians to vastly expand their nuclear program, and that the fact also that the administration is continuing to ignore evidence of that's at the International Atomic Energy Agency of new information indicating this is a weapons program, and yet the administration is stuck in the intelligence fiction from several years ago that they somehow had halted work on nuclear weapons.
We're seeing the North Koreans also continuing and accelerating in some respects their nuclear weapons program. So it seems that though this should not really be a debatable point, that things are getting worse, not better. But Ambassador Joseph tried to connect the dots, as I understand it, between the policies that the U.S. government has been pursuing and things getting worse. It's not just happening coincidentally, right?
Yes, exactly. That's the key point. And he was very harsh in his criticism, stating that they had made concession after concession, and those concessions have been pocketed. And instead of leading to better results, whether it's a negotiated solution or anything, the results are even more dangerous. We now have both of these rogue states on the verge of a breakout into developing real nuclear weapons. The other area that he addressed was the notion of a global zero, the idea that we're all going to give up our nuclear weapons. He said that this was actually creating a drive among rogue states and other countries to develop their own nuclear weapons, because most nations can understand, you know, the facts of the world as they see them. If the Iranians have nuclear weapons or develop them, and if and we know the North Koreans do, the other nations are going to say, well, we can't rely on the United States for a nuclear umbrella or for support. So in a sense, they've compounded the problem by this naive notion that we should just all give up our nuclear weapons.
Now, it's bad enough that the Obama administration, which, as you know very well, Bill Gertz, and have probably done as much as anybody to chronicle, is populated by people who have been naive is being charitable. They have been downright foolish, I think, about these kinds of issues for decades. Rose Gottmuller comes to mind as a prime example at the State Department. But, Bill, what is even more troubling at the moment is just this week we've had rolled out they call it, I guess, an analysis, authored by people who you would think would know better, including a former commanding general of U.S. Strategic Forces Command and former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hoss Cartwright, that basically calls for massive further cuts in our nuclear forces, drawing down from a triad, as they call it, to a dyad, and so on. What's going on here, Bill?
To me, this is an example of what happens when the U.S. military at the highest levels basically gives up the sense of a warrior defense culture and adopts a liberal disarmament arms control approach. And I think that is captured the best in General Cartwright's statements. He was the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was considered Obama's favorite general to succeed Mullen as chairman, and lost out over personal problems. And now he's come out really unveiling his true political views, which are way to the left of even the Obama administration. It's quite stunning, I think.
Well, it remains to be seen how much to the left of the Obama administration they are, because as you've discussed with me before, Bill Gertz, when the president is more flexible after the election, we'll perhaps see him going where these guys are going. He's talking, as you know, with the Pentagon about up to 80% cuts in our strategic nuclear forces. So it may be that he's really of a mind with General Cartwright and others in making this global zero recommendation. But, Bill, just to drill down on that for a moment, who's behind this global zero initiative? I have been told that there are some very wealthy philanthropists, Ted Turner and George Soros, I think, Warren Buffett for sure, who have been bankrolling it. Senator Sam Nunn is another name that I hear frequently in this context, the Nuclear Threat Initiative. What what are these guys doing? And why should we not recognize what they're recommending here is really radical leftist claptrap?
Yeah, it's just, to me, I can't quite understand where this is coming from, other than that there is this groundswell of left-wing disarmament. You know, it harkens back to what, and this is something Bob Joseph mentioned, this goes back to like the 70s when they had the Ban the Bomb movement.
There you go. Well, they're trying, and we must resist, because I think what you've made clear, Bill Gertz, is that it would be our bomb that would be banned effectively, not anybody else's, leaving the world a much more dangerous place, as Bob Joseph says. Bill, in your Inside the Ring column this week, you describe something else that's alarming. It's being done, I guess, technically outside of official auspices, but it seems to track with what the Obama administration is seeking to do with respect to cyber warfare, which is to find ways that they can work with the Chinese to address the threat. What's wrong with this picture? Last time I checked, and I've read in your column many times, the Chinese are the threat. What's going on there?
It's very much akin to what Bob Joseph said about this obsession with engagement. The naive policymakers within the Obama administration believe that if the U.S. were to engage in cyber warfare exercises, even on a non-official basis, that is, ostensibly between a U.S. think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and a Chinese intelligence front organization called the China Institute of Contemporary International Relations. It's a known intelligence front group, and yet they're engaging in cyber warfare exercises, which can only benefit the Chinese effort to develop cyber warfare capabilities and to attack the United States. It's, again, a stunning head-in-the-sand approach to one of the most serious national security problems that we're now facing and will definitely get worse. And that the reason is that the Chinese are the main force behind all of the major cyber attacks and preparations for cyber warfare in the future.
And there's no question in your mind, Bill Gertz, that the Chinese government is involved in those attacks, or at least is enabling their execution against both our government and military and intelligence and civilian commercial sectors as well.
Yeah, right? not just the government. It's the Chinese military and the Chinese military intelligence unit and the Chinese civilian intelligence unit, again, which is represented in this front group called Kicker.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. Bill Gertz, this is why we value so much your insights as well as your reportage. Thanks for doing both, especially here with us. And we'll look forward to your updates on how this craziness, for want of a better term, that Bob Joseph and you have been documenting is continuing to deteriorate our national security capabilities. And it's the unhappy news, I'm afraid, but we need to know it and share it with others. Bill, thank you so much. Best to you for the weekend. We'll look forward to talking with you next week, and we'll look forward to talking to the rest of you next week, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.